Today, our guest is Professor Nick Oliver. Nick is the WIM Professor of Human Metabolism, sorry, mispronounced that, and is a consultant in diabetes and endocrinology at Imperial College Healthcare Trust. His clinical and academic interests include how technologies can be developed and applied to meet the challenges of living with type 1 diabetes, as well as other things, because I know he's involved in lots of research of lots of different areas. So hello, Nick, and how are you?
Hello, I'm all right, thank you. If you can hear funny noises, it's a dog eating a tennis ball. I promise you it's not me.
That's fine. You can snack if you like, but
I don't even like tennis balls.
Well, you know, keep you busy, no calories and things like that. So what we normally do, Nick, is we start off with what we call 90-second questions, which is just a quick, just a bit of an opener, just to get things going. They're not that deep questions, do not worry. So are you ready to start?
Ready when you are.
Okay then, how would you describe your role?
90 seconds. I mean, surely give me 90 minutes.
In a sentence or so.
And why? Where are my slides? I want my slides. My role. I have a very privileged role. I get to do type 1 diabetes clinics with a fantastic MDT and with brilliant colleagues. And when I'm not doing that, I get to do research in nerdy stuff that I've been into for years. So I'm very fortunate. I have great colleagues. I have fun stuff to do most of the time.
Okay. Well, the rest of the questions are a lot simpler. So if you had diabetes, what do you think would be your hypo treatment of choice?
Oh, God, that is a good one, you know. I think this is a really hard one, isn't it? Because I don't really know what I would fancy, but the sort of sweet things, I don't have a brilliantly sweet tooth, but I quite like sort of fruit pastels and what are those sort of sour gums? Are they Maynard sour gums? I really like those. And you can't beat a jelly baby. I mean, bite the head off and off you go, right?
Yeah, no, jelly babies are quite a go-to. I have to be honest, I've moved to Love Hearts recently, which I'm really enjoying. But anyway, do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
Do you want the really nerdy answer to that?
Yeah.
The smell is not insulin. Insulin does not have a smell. The smell that you get from insulin preparations is the additives that go in it, things like phenol and metacresol, and they stink. I sort of have mixed feelings about it. I don't really like the smell, but I do like that it's easy to identify. And if you get leaks or spillage and stuff, it's very easy to know that your pen is leaking or that your pen is not properly. So it's a bit of a useful canary in the coal mine. But no, I don't really like the smell in itself.
A bit like TCP, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite or go-to insulin?
Oh yeah, so I've got a favourite and I've got a most loathed insulin as well. Am I allowed to say these?
Well, it's you who's got to say them. There's no repercussions on me.
I don't know. I don't know if there's some ABPI thing that means I'm not. So I still have a soft spot for Insulatard, for old school NPH human insulin. Goodness. I think that is a great product. But my probable favourite is Levemir, which, to be honest, is very similar to Insulatard in its profile. But I think that is a fantastic insulin for MDI, certainly. And just so there's balance, so Novo Nordisk or anyone else doesn't complain, the insulin I loathe is Traceba. I can't bear Traceba. I know it has its place.
Is that just because of the length of that it's in the body?
Yeah. Yeah. So loads of people ended up taking it or being prescribed it when they had problematic hypoglycemia with type 1 diabetes. And the evidence base does suggest that you have slightly less exposure to hypoglycemia than with some insulins. But the problem is, it, it ended up being prescribed to sort of people in their 20s and 30s and 40s who have variable lives and jobs and exercise and activity and unpredictability, and you know, life gets in the way. And the problem is, if you want to do some exercise with Traceba and you want to go out for a run on a Wednesday, you needed to reduce your dose on Sunday, and it's nobody's got that foresight. I mean I slightly exaggerate, but only slightly.
I
don't see the results in the majority of people with type 1 diabetes. I'm sure it has a place, but not in my clinic room.
okay, controversial, but we'll go with that. What's one thing that's a positive for you for working in the arena of diabetes?
Apart from being paid.
Well, actually, that's a big positive, I suppose.
I mean, it certainly puts food on the table. What's a big positive? I mean, the whole thing's a privilege, isn't it? So actually, I did clinic this afternoon, and I had an F1 first year junior doctor who came down and sat in clinic with me. And actually, I think the privilege is that you're a part of a long-term condition. And I know some healthcare professionals don't feel this, and they would like to treat and for that to be the sort of the end of the thing. But I love the fact that I see people. Yeah. And one of the people I saw has had type 1 diabetes since 1967. And you know, I wasn't practicing then. But you know, he remembers everyone, all of the doctors, all of the consultants, and I really like the fact that he has sort of been part of the journey for me, and we're hopefully a good part of the journey for people living with diabetes.
No, that is very true. I had a friend, which is totally different, and she's not got type 1, but she's got a liver condition, and when she was diagnosed with it, her consultant said to her, well, hello, we'll get to know each other. I'll know all about your family and you'll get to know about mine, because we're going to see each other for a long time. And
yeah,
I thought that's sort of,
it's a privilege though,
sort
isn't it?
Summed
it's
up lovely. Yeah, you're going to be involved in your life, and I suppose that's one of the reasons it's important to get somebody that you do click with as well. It's not like a broken arm where you're going to see them for you know, a month or two and then never see them again, hopefully. But hey ho. And a last question. If you were stranded on a desert island, what three things would you take with you? Now, I will have to proviso that some people take very practical things.
How strict are the rules? Is this like desert island days?
Well, we're not that strict. Some people take survival things, but then other people take things to keep them amused and entertained.
I mean, an ocean going would be good. Can I have one
of
those?
What, sorry?
Can I have a cruise liner?
No, because that wouldn't fit on the island, would it?
Okay, can I have quite a large boat that would fit on the island, and a launch jetty and a large supply of fuel?
Okay. We have let people have mobile phones and things like that. So.
Oh, God, that's the last thing I want. Please, no, I don't want a mobile phone. I mean, you need to have a mobile phone mast as well, don't you?
Well, no, but it just worked. It'd be satellite or something like that. But you could call for help. Plus, you'd have books.
Okay.
You'd have music. You'd have a lot of it, a mobile phone. Anyway, that...
I think I'd last about 3 days and then I'd go nuts.
Yeah, I tend to think I'd be the same. That or starve. do that. Well, that was the quick just getting to know each other. Bit of an icebreaker. So we'll go now to the simple questions. As you've said,
whenever anyone says simple questions, you know what's coming, don't you? This is going to be the horriblest question ever.
No, we're very friendly here, Nick. We are. You've sort of said that obviously diabetes pays the bills, which is a really good thing. Can you tell me, why did you end up specialising in diabetes? Was it something that you'd thought of for a long time, or was it just something you happened upon in your training and thought, oh, this might be interesting? Why?
It would have been 2002, I think. And I was a junior doctor. I was working at Hillingdon Hospital out in West London. And I had no idea really what I wanted to do. I knew that I didn't want to be a surgeon. I didn't get any particular satisfaction from doing surgery. It just felt stressful. And I wasn't very good at it. So I knew that I wanted to do something medical. I didn't want to do general practice or psychiatry. So I was getting quite good at ticking stuff off, but I had no idea really what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And actually, so I had a sort of short list. I quite like respiratory medicine. Renal medicine seemed quite interesting. And reflecting on this, they're all the same thing, where you look after long-term conditions and establish relationships with the people who you're supporting, which has only struck me much more recently. But actually, I then ended up working for Rowan Hilson, who was a consultant at Hillingdon, and she was inspirational. And I think this is the case for lots of people in medicine and probably in lots of other careers. You happen to be in the right place at the right time with the right person. And I worked with her and some lovely registrars, the two Michaels, Michael Badman and Michael Yee. Michael Yee's now a consultant colleague of mine, and Michael Badman's fantastically successful in the United States. And we had a great time. We had a really good laugh, which is important. And Rowan was a great teacher. She was hugely supportive. She was a brilliant advocate for the people who she looked after, both on the ward and in the clinic. And she made diabetes interesting, and she would buy us a croissant after every ward round, and that is golden. So I was really just inspired by her and the team that she ran, the unit she ran, and that was that really. And I don't know how many of you know Rowan, but she then subsequently became the National Clinical Director for Diabetes and Obesity before Jonathan Valanche.
Oh.
So she was NCD before Jonathan. Gosh, that would have been 10 years ago that she finished the role. So different governments and a different time. But yeah, it was really just working with her. And then and you never know if you made the right decision, do you?
No.
But I've certainly never stayed up at night and thought regretful thoughts about my career.
Oh, no, that's good. And just because I did at one point work at Hillingdon Hospital, did they still have curry days when you were there?
Thursday curry day. Living the dream.
Was it a Wednesday or a Thursday? Thursday curry day. The best day of the week.
Thursday, yeah. Well, Friday fish and chips is pretty good as well. But yeah, Thursday curry day, brilliant.
Best Lovely. Curries you've ever had.
Yeah.
If anybody's ever visiting Hillingdon on a Thursday, go and get a curry. It is so good.
Well, I left 20 years ago. I mean, it may not be there now.
I was just thinking how long ago.
Special journey.
Yeah, I'm just thinking how long ago it was. Actually, it's probably about 17 years ago for me.
Yeah. All right. You and me, let's go. Let's go out west.
Yes.
And go and have a curry.
And check.
We'll turn up and it'll be closed. Yes,
they won't have it. I'll be so upset if that's the case. So within diabetes, what areas of it do you find most interesting? You've said about the relationship with the people, which, you know, I can't say it's a bad thing being one of those people. Not that you're my consultant, I'll just add that. But as a person with type 1, what's the areas that interest you apart from the long-term relationship?
I think I've really changed over the. I mean, I started my first year as a diabetes registrar was 2003, so I'm now into my 21st year of being a specialist. And I think it changes, and it partly changes because the tools that we have as healthcare professionals change. You know, when I first did clinics, it was the Enormo clinic, which some of you might remember. You know, 40, 50 people in the waiting room. 5-minute conversation, take a bit more rapid with lunch, see you in 6 months, make sure you bring your book next time, you know, those sorts of frankly pointless conversations.
Yep.
For the person with diabetes and pointless for us as well. We didn't achieve anything. It was pre-structured education, pre-Daphne, and I don't really know why we persisted in doing it for so long, but you know, we've developed so much now, and over that time the interest has been in the newer insulins and then novel sensing and sharing an evidence base that continues to be co-sensors, and we've worked on AI and decision support systems, and we've worked on all sorts of cool stuff. And And the technology has completely changed the way we deliver type 1 diabetes care and completely changed the way that people self-manage, hopefully mostly for the better. But I think the thing that I have gravitated towards recently has been psychology of living with diabetes, and particularly living with type 1 diabetes, which I think, that's been a complete revelation. If we think that CGM's a revelation, the thought of having a psychologist in clinic 20 years ago would, I don't know what would have happened, but I think people would just looked at me like I was probably needing a psychologist myself. But actually, the person I've learned the most from in the last 5 to 10 years is our highly specialist clinical psychologists, and the work that they do and the research that they do exploring how people live with type 1 diabetes, I think is absolutely wonderful and so important in how we deliver care more effectively and more acceptably, and hopefully more impactfully. And things like, you were all talking about DIY closed loop and open source solutions while I was earwigging before this started. The way that people approach all of those things is so variable and so nuanced and so important. And obviously type 1 disordered eating is incredibly important to understand and to develop interventions for. And we're really, in psychology terms, we're at the point of understanding the phenomena, but we're nowhere near understanding effective interventions, really. So actually, if you want to think about what the next frontier is in type 1, certainly it's going to be things like what are the effective interventions for that support well-being and not, I didn't say wellness because I have a thing about wellness, but support mental health and well-being in a way that's really effective, and that's been fascinating.
I so agree with you, because I think the longer I've had type 1, the more I realise it's as much a mental game, if not more of a mental game, than a physical one.
I think it's totally a mental game,
and
isn't it?
It's so relentless and it's so whatever, and I always think that, well, I don't know, but another lifelong condition that you're expected to do so much for independently, make decisions, the pressure of it, the relentlessness, and no support is even offered.
There's nothing like it. People say, oh, about asthma or anything. Of course, living with any long-term condition can be challenging, distressing, but there's nothing like type 1 diabetes. For the burden of decision making, and for the burden of managing the outcomes of that decision making, and as you say, no one around you can really understand unless they also have type 1, and even then, everyone's experiences can be really different. I don't have type 1, but it must be just incredibly challenging.
And one of my things, and I'll just say it because you're a doctor and you may already do this, it always amazes me that when people are diagnosed, you're always warned of the possibilities of having problems with your eyes, your kidneys, all things like that. And I don't know anybody who's had mentioned to them diabetes distress, or you are going to get burnout, you are going to, this is normal, come and speak to us.
Yeah.
And I just don't get that, because I think probably more people are going to suffer from that.
Yeah, well, I think everybody does at some
and
point.
Yeah,
don't
they? And sooner than the other things, hopefully.
Well, this is weird. Were you in my clinic room this afternoon? I had this exact conversation with the junior doctor, because we were talking about how you do messaging at diagnosis. I always say it won't take a day of your life, and you don't have to have complications, because both of those things are true. The best epidemiology, the best up-to-date data suggests that as long as you don't have any kidney disease, you have no lost years with type 1 diabetes compared to people without type 1 diabetes, and complications are absolutely not inevitable, and I always say that, and I don't even bother telling people what the complications are. You don't need to know that at diagnosis, do you? Yes, of course that information needs to be given later, but why?
Yeah.
Someone's just got a life-changing diagnosis, why tell them that there is risk of neuropathy or nephropathy or retinopathy later in life? It's just not important right then. And absolutely, we don't talk about this. I mean, I do say this won't take a day of your life. It will be a pain in the ass sometimes. But actually, you're right. Maybe I should say, be clearer. There are days when this will be exhausting and frustrating, and tell us about it. I suppose the thing that makes me slightly anxious about that is that actually, please don't tell me about it. I'm a clinician. I don't know how to. This is what I'm saying. I don't know what the intervention for that is. I'm being slightly flippant. No. Please do tell me, and I'm very happy to listen and try to help. But actually, what we need is an intervention, and we need a highly skilled MDT that has psychologists that are accessible in every clinic across the country, so that we can do this in a way that is just as evidence-based as using insulin pump therapy.
Yeah, but I think also knowing that it's normal is as much, even if you can't, there's certain things that people can't do anything about. It's like if I'm having a day and my blood sugars are just through the roof and I can think of no reason for it, I've tried everything I can, and I'm just like, insulin's water today, there's nothing that I can do about it. But I know that that happens. And do you know, like, you just have to learn to accept it, but just knowing that it happens is a consolation, that I'm not the only person who that happens to.
Yeah.
That it's not me going mad.
No, that messaging is so important, isn't it? This is normal. This is okay. I think the really hard thing, I imagine the really hard thing, is dusting yourself off for the next day.
Yeah.
No, there are going to be days when it's just, who knows what's, but it is, it's just one of those days. It's the dusting yourself off to go again the next day, isn't it? That just must be so challenging sometimes.
I think sometimes it's a relief that, you know, well, tomorrow's another day. Let's see what I wake up to.
Such an optimist.
You know me, Nick. No, it's sort of there. I think it's just being forewarned of those things at times, and the unpredictability is part of it. I think also when I was diagnosed, but I don't think this is the case now, I didn't actually speak to another person with type 1 for 17 years. Just because of the way my clinic was structured, it was in a... just a open clinic, so you could be sat next to somebody who's waiting for dermatology, so you weren't chatting. And I was always told, and at the time I think the range you were given was 4 to 7, and I had the impression through the number of times I was told off that everybody else managed that, and I hadn't a hope in hell. I must have passed through those ranges to get from my highs to my lows, but that was about it. And I remember the first time I spoke to somebody with type 1, which was at Daphne, and they were all the same as me. They were high and low and this, that and the other. And that was such a relief to me, because I just thought, this is something I cannot do. I don't understand how people do it. And just to hear that actually very few people could do that, if anybody, and I was just normal. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of the power of Daphne is just sitting down with people who you know have type 1 with you. And no one's ever been able to sort of deconstruct which bits of structured education are effective. I'm sure the information is sometimes useful. I question sometimes how important carbohydrate counting is. I wish they'd called it carbohydrate estimating at the start. No one counts. Let's get over it, shall we? And if you do count, the only thing I can promise you is that you're wrong.
Swagging. I like it. If you heard that, scientific wild ass guess. You don't count,
well,
you swag.
Live by that. Yeah, no, absolutely. Carb swag. Let's do it. There are, as you know, you know, hundreds of people, thousands of people who are still in a WhatsApp group with their Daphne group years later, and who still just occasionally say hi and pop up to offer support, and I think just knowing it's there must be so lovely. Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, presumably also sometimes people don't want to be part of the group, but that's cool. You can choose to do that too.
Yeah. It's really nice talking about the psychological side.
But you said that you didn't know anyone for 17 years.
Yeah.
With hindsight, do you think that's true, or do you just think that nobody talked
about
it?
Well, I didn't knowingly know anybody. Let's put it like that.
Yeah. Do you think people are more open now, though? Or I mean, there's the visibility thing that if it's summer and you're in a vest top, then you've got Libra, then that's that. Isn't
I was going to say, senses make a difference, because you can. You in the summer, definitely you can see them more often. I'm not saying everybody, because people obviously, you don't always find them to see. So it's easier spotting people that way. And I may have spoken to people, but I didn't know I was. I don't know. But I think it would have made a difference. I think that that feeling of failure wouldn't have been there. Maybe I would have, you know me, not backwards at coming forwards, Nick.
Really? You hide it so well.
Well, you would have thought that. But I think I maybe would have stood up a bit more to the consultant who I did not get on with.
But that comes back to that thing, doesn't it? You have of establishing a relationship, and it's so important that you find a way to muddle along between you, to be constructive as a relationship, or you get that take one more rat trap with lunch, see you in a year, which didn't do anything for anyone.
And I know once this is all about me now, Nick. I remember once I said, look, I just don't get it. I was thinking, I'm just going to be honest about it because this just isn't working. And do you know how it was one of the things that I was utterly failing at? And do you know how, don't get me wrong, I do not excel at everything, but I've very rarely had something that's important to me that I just hadn't got a grasp of at all. And I was very honest, saying, well, it's just not working. I just don't understand why not. And the answer was, we've just got to try harder.
Well, that's what I say all the time.
Yeah.
Just try more.
You know,
try more. You're not trying enough. Yeah. There's so many stories like that, aren't there? And that's the definition of how not to give someone the tools to achieve their goal, isn't it? But the other thing about this concept of normality, or this concept of what optimal glucose looks like, is that we used to say, you know, your target pre-meal is 4 to 7, or your target 2 hours after a meal is less than 11. But CGM has shown us that we were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair to us, we didn't understand that any more than people with diabetes understood it. And the information that we were giving, we thought was appropriate. But I tell this story a lot, but I have worn CGM at various times for various reasons. And I once made homemade, nothing exciting, I made a chicken risotto, delicious, by the way. It might have been mushroom, maybe it was mushroom. I made a homemade risotto. It was very nice, and it's the last risotto I've ever eaten. And this was about 5 years ago. And the reason was I was wearing Dexcom G6,
mm-hmm.
and about 45 minutes after I'd eaten, not a massive bowl, but a nice bowl of risotto, my glucose was 11.7 with two up arrows. And I do not have type 1 diabetes, and my HbA1c remains normal several years later. And it just it's such an important thing that's lodged in my brain that nobody has flat glucose. Normal glucose tolerance on a CGM will show you all sorts of wild stuff. And you know, I worry about all this Zoe nonsense, because it's just teaching people that post-meal glucose spikes are somehow pathological. They're not. That's how you make it. That's why you secrete insulin. Yeah. It's a response
that is so lovely to hear, Nick, that the watcher has become the watched.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you know, I spend a lot of my time in clinic telling people that story and saying my glucose is 11.72 up arrows. Don't worry about it. It's normal glucose tolerance to have that. Don't correct it. Sit on it. Stop looking. Turn your alarms on. And actually, you were talking about G7 alerts, weren't you? And the G before I pop my head up and declared that I was here. But I mean, G7's got that slightly odd snooze thing, hasn't it? That you can,
oh, that's fantastic.
You can tell it to shut up. Yeah, exactly. But unless I had seen that, I wouldn't really have understood what that's for. But yeah, I mean, absolutely.
No, that's for when you're at theatres, in weddings, christenings, funerals, concerts. I can tell you 100
quite a few.
Do you snooze?
Do you think
it's not after a meal?
Do you think that has for you know, people of a certain age and you know, historically, do you think that whole clinic turn up with your book and there were snapshots that were accusingly and accusing snapshots. So you were never, particularly with your book, you were never bothered about the fours and fives and sixes and sevens, but the occasional high one, where those sometimes you felt as though those were looked at in greater detail. Me in particular, whenever I see those, what I know with CGM, I see them as being normal ups and downs, and but there's still a historical kind of DNA defense mechanism for the older type ones that it's baked into our DNA now that we become very defensive over anything that's got double up arrows or double down arrows.
Yeah,
I think it's the way it's approached.
Baked by us, isn't it? Well, so I mean, it's a very weird thing that we did, isn't it? So we spent time saying glucose below four is less good, and glucose above whatever is less good. And when we went through books, we would point those ones out. And what we've done, though, is we've said, OK, we're going to attach value judgments to numbers. We did this, not people with diabetes. We're going to attach value numbers. And in between the times when we see you, we're going to make you write those down. You know, what bizarre cruelty is that? We're going to make you write down our value judgments of your self-management, and you're going to do it 4 to 7 times a day. You know, this is a weird thing to do, isn't it? We could have done that better, I'm sure.
But it's even worse, Nick.
We've baked in all of that.
Yeah, but you've made us do it, and then you turn up having done it, because I'm that fool that did. And then you'd hardly look at it. And I'm like, you realise?
I've spent 15 minutes in the car park with 6 different coloured pens.
No, I never did that.
Apparently.
It was either there or it wasn't there. There was no pretending.
Who was the same the other day?
But it's the same with CGM now.
Well, I have to say, you talking about the psychology, because this isn't the conversation we were going to have, Nick, but we're going there because I'm really enjoying it. I think what I find now, because we were going to go more techie, I still have a lot of techie questions. But I don't know if you believe this, that I think actually in some ways clinicians, I feel, need to be a bit more sensitive, because CGM just lays you bare. That's my whole life.
So I was going to say exactly the same. Yeah. So we are doing the same. So that thing that we did, we baked in value judgments about numbers and then made you parade them in front of us. We're doing the same with CGM, with this obsession with downloads. And it drives me nuts. CGM and to be honest, self-monitored capillary glucose years ago, they are real-time tools to enable decision making and self-management.
Yes,
they are not. Yeah. There is no so you, none of you will find an evidence base anywhere for retrospective review of self-monitored blood glucose and type 1 diabetes. There is not an evidence base that a structured review of your book changed your HbA1c or any outcome. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's a farce. And it's the same with downloads. There are no studies that say that sitting and reviewing a download in clinic changes an outcome, and I do not do it because, I mean, this sounds trite and a bit cheesy. I'm not, the download's not my patient. The person living with diabetes is the person who's come to see me, and that's the person who I will offer help to in any way I can. I'm not trying to treat a download. It's gone. It's history.
Do you not look for patterns though within them? Because I'm fine with looking at patterns. Because it's something that happens repeatedly.
For me, my first few months on the Libra, the real absolute crucial thing for me was not seeing the dots per day, per hour, per minute, but seeing the patterns. And then that immediately becomes that relationship between I took my insulin there, and then all of a sudden I could see there and the food. And for me, the absolute real power was being able to see patterns and stories start to emerge about the way I was, that's the real, that for me was the real key. It was at the light bulb. Brilliant.
Yeah. So you didn't need anyone to do it in clinic because you'd already done it.
No, but it was a conjunction thing. I mean, obviously sitting down with my consultant and my DSNs, it started to make a bit more sense, you know, in terms of those, particularly on how insulin was working, and you know, all of a sudden it became less of a kind of black art and more of a it's knowledge, isn't it? It's what you've been saying, Nick. It's about knowledge.
I will do that. Yeah. I'm being slightly curmudgeon-y deliberately, but I don't. I will only do them if there's a reason to do them.
Yeah.
So yeah. My starting point is how are you, and then how are your sugars, how's your diabetes, and actually most of the time people know the answer to that question, so I don't need to do a download. You said about patterns, but I very few people, when you look at patterns with them, go, oh, that's a surprise.
Yeah.
If you pull it up and it shows that they've had a few hypos at 3 a.m, they go, yeah, I've been up a bit. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't need to download. I can say, what about hypos? How have you been getting on? And they will tell me. Or I can ask about glucose in the morning, or, you know.
Yeah.
You know, actually ask the person, and when they tell you, believe them.
Yeah.
It seems very straightforward to me. If the answer is, I don't know, then... And the second thing is, and the HbA1c is not close to target, then I'll offer to have a look with them. But someone looked at me today, it took me ages to remember my password to log in. Right? Like, what are you doing? Why haven't you got my download up ready? Because I'm not.
Yeah.
It's not terribly interesting to me. And the other thing that somebody said to me last year, actually, and this is going to be true, downloads are a flash in the pan. Because there's absolutely no point in me looking at a download for anyone on a hybrid closed loop because I cannot see what the basal insulin is doing.
Yeah.
So I can do nothing about it. And actually, to be honest, everyone's got an HbA1c that is somewhere between 48 and 58 anyway. So what am I going to do about it anyway? So hybrid closed loop is going to kill off downloads for almost everybody. And there will be occasional people on multiple dose injection regimens who you want to try and interrogate patterns with because they haven't been able to pick it out because there's a bit of chaos or whatever reason. But downloads are short-lived, not here to stay, and not a big deal. And again, you know, time downloads don't change anything. Time in range is not as tightly associated with complications as HbA1c. HbA1c is still the king, and long may it reign.
I suppose looking at it from my point of view as the person, and I appreciate from the medical side, the HbA1c is still what's seen, but I see it as in conjunction with time in range, because, do you know, like then you've got the average and you've got the variance. So
which one gives you variance?
Well, if you're time in range, if I'm got a fantastic HbA1c, but I'm 10% in range, that means I'm going up and down.
But that doesn't happen though. They're so tightly associated with each other. They correlate beautifully. That's why you get a GMI from your download.
But that's often wrong. CGM,
it's not far off. Don't forget the lab's often wrong. But this is the other thing that we always assume, the lab's right. The lab's not right. HbA1c, the coefficient of variance of HbA1c in the lab, yeah, it's plus or minus a few, and the variance of a GMI is plus or minus a few. They're really close, you know. So GMI falls over at the very bottom end.
Yeah.
So if you've got an HbA1c of around sort of 6% in old money, 42% in new money, GMI is a bit rubbish. And it's probably a bit rubbish if you're up in the hundreds, so 10-11% in old money. But you know, at those ends, who cares?
Well, I suppose that's the thing, that maybe that is, because so many more people, and I know I'm living in a bubble of people who do loop. As more people do loop, more people are getting better I hate to give a value judgment on an HbA1c, but shall we say the sort of target ones, you are more likely to be there or whatever, because you've got a system doing lots of things for you whilst you sleep and everything. But this is one of the questions which actually I had as my thoughts were talking about hybrid closed loops, and we're talking about CGM. Are there certain circumstances, because obviously, like any population, we have comorbidities, different conditions, and different things. Are there certain conditions or treatments thereof that make CGM not that accurate? Because as we're going down the hybrid closed loop for more and more people, what things are there that will make it impractical for certain people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's a very simple answer, which is there are some drugs that obviously interact with CGM, yeah. And that's well understood, and we can avoid those drugs in general. But there's also a little bit of black magic here, isn't there? Because there are some people who get on brilliantly with some sensors and terribly yeah. with other sensors, and vice versa. And I have no good explanation for that. You know, it's not about contact dermatitis from the adhesive. It's not about interfering drugs. It's not about it's not about where they put the sensor. It's simply that one works better with them than another.
Yeah.
And nobody's offered me a good explanation for that, and I've not been able to understand one. But this is great, isn't it? That if we recognise that and say, oh, I'm really sorry that Libre didn't work for you, this is no problem. You can have the Medtronic system, or you can try Dexcom, you can try G7 or G6. And yeah, this is great. We're in a really privileged position. We can offer people choice, and we have alternatives. It would be nice to understand why some sensors work well in some and not so well in others, but I, you know, we may never get a good explanation. It's the same with insulin, to be honest, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some seem to last ages in some people and disappear quickly in others. You know, this is why medicine's fun, because everyone's different.
Well, that's like Fiasp, isn't it? That doesn't work for quite a few people, but I know other people who love it and have been on it for years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's sort of like that. I suppose with the CGM, we were talking about it earlier, and having the choice is fantastic, but I suppose with the 4-year lock into pumps, I think that's one of the issues, that if something stops working for you, you then can't loop till you can get a new pump, because at the moment lots of them aren't interoperable across CGM systems.
Well, Tandem will be compatible with Libre and G6 and G7 soon enough.
Yeah.
Omnipod will too. Cambridge system. Yeah, interoperability is problematic for understandable, if not entirely good reasons, but wholly understandable reasons. And you know, it's the same in all industries, and it's the same in all medicine. You know, you can't use an endoscopy from one manufacturer with a screen set up from a different manufacturer, and those are really good safety reasons for doing that. I think it's very clear that people would like to have a degree of choice in their system and how it works. But the slightly grumpy medical response to this is no good evidence that any of the systems are any worse than any others. They're all fantastic. They all are slightly better at one small thing than another, but everyone gets 70-odd% time in range with any of the hybrid closed loops, as long as they're implemented appropriately. So, you know, no big deal. Let people choose their sensor.
Yeah, no. And that is one of the questions, leads me on to one of the questions that I did have.
Perfectly segue.
Yeah, it was actually, Nick. It's even as though we planned it and we didn't.
Don't tell them that.
I don't want them thinking we've colluded.
Okay, no, true.
With hybrid closed loop, like you say, I think all the commercial ones, I suppose it's a bit like insulin pumps. Basically, they all do the same job, but in slightly different ways. And, you know, that's great. And hybrid closed loops, they work differently, but, you know, each have their little idiosyncratic things that they might be better. And I know that definitely with my clinic, when I last changed pump, which is a few years ago, I was like just given a list of pumps and sort of said, oh, these are your options, which do you want? And I was sort of thinking, from a person with type 1 being given that, I know quite a few people who use the different systems, and I sort of knew some of the differences. But what do you think are some of the things that people who maybe don't know all the ins and outs of all the pumps should think about? Actually, healthcare professionals to think about, as well as the person, between choosing between the different systems. Oh, there's some that suit different types of people. I know I have my opinion on a couple of them, but types of people that should, that yeah, systems would suit better for.
I have opinions. So I think the thing that I always land on is that I'm not using or wearing this.
Yeah.
So you know what? Here's your choices. Here's what they look like. Here's what they feel like. Here's how much they weigh. Here are some tips and things that I've been told by other people living with type one about where to put it, how to handle it. But fundamentally, yeah, I try and keep my opinion out of it because I don't have to wear it. Fundamentally, you tell me what you want. And if I roll my eyes, I'll try and do it while I'm looking at the screen.
Can I tell you where I come from on this one?
Yeah.
I use the T-Slim. I like the T-Slim because I set my basal rates, which means if I know I'm going to have a particularly active day, so I'm going out for, I go for a 10-mile walk, I know I can reduce my basal and I can still use the loop. Brilliant. If I had one that had a dynamic basal, I'd either have to decide to turn off the system, or I know I can raise my target and ease off and whatever. But anyway, I like the T-Slim because I have that control over the basal. But I think for some people, if they're not going to be interactive and do that, maybe a dynamic basal will be better for them because it's a bit more plug and play.
Yeah, I mean, the way you describe that is interesting, isn't it? Because you basically describe three different ways to address a very active day. So you've got ease off, you've got exercise modes, or if able to, you can increase the target, or you can change the underlying basal rates. And it just makes the point, doesn't it, that they're all slightly customizable, but in slightly faffy different ways. And it depends on how much people want to engage with their system and use different features. I mean, I think the one thing they all have in common is that they're all at the moment pretty weak around exercise.
Yeah.
And actually, if to be really fair to the systems, that's probably not a failing of the system. It's probably a failing of the pharmacology of subcutaneous insulin, which remains remains probably the really weak point of all of the closed loop systems.
Yeah.
It's hard to get into that nuance, isn't it, when you've got a 30-minute clinic slot and you're trying to make a decision. And it's also hard for people to know what the right answer for them will be in the future.
Yeah.
So I think I try and focus a bit more on sort of the practical stuff. There are solutions and workarounds for almost everything. It's just about finding the one that works for you. I mean, I think the biggest issue at the moment is patch or tubed, and that seems to be the major decision that people make first off at the moment. Obviously, if you choose a patch pump, you have a second controller as well at the moment. So, I don't mind. Yeah. You'll get 70-odd% time in range with all of them. You'll get an HbA1c between 48 and 58 with all of them. They will all have reasonably minimal exposure to hypoglycemia. And you know, they all have good bits and bad bits. Choose the one that you fancy.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, I think there's a slight risk here that we get overexcited. These are still early generation devices.
Yeah.
They are still prone to not always doing the thing that you expect them to do. There is a recent paper published that shows that people are still having severe hypoglycemia and DKA on hybrid closed loop systems, and that's probably not surprising if we really thought about it. But we're not at the sort of plug and play. This is near to a cure. They still need a lot of work.
Yes.
Sometimes, and they can still, just as an open loop pump or a pen, they can still be something you want to throw out of the window as violently as you can at any given moment.
I think they help, but I always say to people, well, there's still work involved and you're still involved.
Yeah.
In it, and you have to know how your algorithm works because you've got to work with the algorithm, not against it.
There's that horrible phrase, isn't there, in media, artificial pancreas, which every time I see that, it's like, no.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's just wrong. It's not artificial, it's real, and it's not a pancreas.
It's almost, you know, that's almost on the same level as cinnamon.
Cinnamon works. What do you mean? that and turmeric.
Yes.
Rub it into your eyes twice a night.
You have to put it on okra.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. That's why it doesn't work.
And that's why you're still having to prescribe insulin and pumps to people, Nick.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? That's just sprung to mind here. All pumps now that are given out, I am assuming, and I'm trying to think of one that's not, have a loop system that go with them. So all pumps prescribed now are loopable.
Cannot buy an open loop. Well, you can buy an open loop pump, but you can't buy a pump that is not loopable.
Do you still start people on non-looping with a pump? Or would you only start somebody and loop them?
I can't think of a scenario where you would give somebody a device that's capable of being a hybrid closed loop but not enable them to use it. That would feel like an oddly punitive, unhelpful thing to do, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm not saying that, but I know when I went on a pump, obviously loopable pumps weren't commercially available. I don't think they were even DIY available. They must have been available somewhere anyway. And just being on a pump was still very, very helpful to me. I mean, it was amazing. Looping is better, but just having a pump was a lot better than injections. So there still are advantages to having an open loop pump. But it was just a thought, because I was thinking, like you were saying, why would you? Why would you not start somebody looping at the same time?
So some people, so this comes back to psychology of living with type 1 and self-managing, and I'm slightly self-conscious because I see Rose Stewart's just joined. hi, Rose. There are still some people who feel uncomfortable about ceding control to a device.
Oh, it is difficult to start with.
Oh, no, absolutely. There are still some people living with type 1 diabetes who prefer to make decisions themselves, and for those people they can turn it on and off as they like. I've had reasonably frequent conversations where I say to people, why don't you, if you're uncomfortable during the day, you run it during the day, but why don't you just switch it on at night and you'll wake up every morning with the glucose somewhere between 5 and 7 and a flattish arrow, and that will set you up for the day, and you don't, and hopefully you don't need to worry so much about overnight hypoglycemia. And it does enable you to have that choice of doing those things. Open loop, as you say, this is a part of an ecosystem of intervention, isn't it? That includes half unit pens and carbohydrate swag, and sensor first. You know, I think there's no reason why anyone shouldn't have a sensor almost immediately, and then if they want a pump or there's benefit from pump, you can add a pump. Everyone needs to be able to use the pump in a open loop configuration, because sensors fail
and sometimes are just inaccurate, like for the first 24 hours.
Absolutely. And then finally you switch on the hybrid closed loop and away you go, hopefully.
Are you all right for a few more minutes?
Sure. I mean, only if people want me to be all right for a few more minutes.
But I have one question I just want to ask you about. Please. I read I think it was the end of last year, a paper came out regarding stigma and adults with diabetes and their experiences. And I believe you were one of the names on it.
So Rose, please unmute and chip in, because Rose has also just published in Diabetic Medicine on this. So stigma's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think everyone has feelings of stigma about some things, some aspects of them, but living with a long-term condition is a really fantastic way to develop stigmatized thoughts and beliefs. And diabetes is because it's so mixed up in the media and the way that the relationships between type 1 and type 2 get portrayed, there are huge amounts of issues around this. And actually, one of the problems with type 1 diabetes and stigma is that we don't really know the baseline even. We don't know where we're starting from. So what we don't know is the incidence, prevalence, severity, and associations of stigma for people living with type 1 diabetes. Diabetes UK did what was really just a survey of people living with type 1 diabetes to ask them questions. And we really just wrote up that survey as an early starter. Yeah. And it was really interesting because there were some questions there that tried to think about where stigma came from. And I'm sorry to say some of it comes from healthcare professionals. Yeah. That won't be hugely surprising to anyone listening, but that is obviously really disappointing. Some of it comes from other people with diabetes, and perhaps some of it is that thing you were saying about earlier about expectations. And social media hasn't always helped this. I mean, no. I think this is a wonderful format, but you know, people are sometimes very happy to write things about their own data that aren't necessarily helpful to other people. And some of it comes from family and friends who are, I think, trying to be helpful, but in doing so, inadvertently cause stigma. So we're trying to understand better stigma in type 1 diabetes, but it comes back to that thing I said earlier. It's not just about understanding it and its associations. We also want to understand how it evolves. So a much more granular investigation led by psychologists. This is not my field. This is true qualitative research into how it actually evolves and is understood. And where this needs to go is into a scenario where we have prevention, so we have clarity about understanding how we avoid stigma arising, and in cases where stigma has arisen, we need to understand what interventions might be helpful in reducing those feelings of being stigmatized for living with type 1 diabetes.
And it was quite interesting, because I had a quick look at it yesterday, because I know when I read it, there were two things that really struck me. Was it said with, and I think it was particularly in people who had type 2 diabetes, they actually believed the misconceptions. So they wouldn't question it themselves because they believed it to be true. And that really struck me that, do you know, like education about your own condition? If you knew it was true, then you could, I'm not saying you're going to do it in all circumstances because sometimes it's just not worth it. But if you know what's true, you can like stand up for yourself. And then there was the other one, which was even more interesting to me, was the people who said they didn't experience stigma. And then some of the people kept a diary for a couple of weeks. And in the diary listed instances of stigma. And that was just like, so you don't know about stigma, but you're writing it down in your diary.
Well, there's two things there, aren't there? So it depends on how you conceive stigma. So people can say stigmatizing things to you, but you may not feel stigmatized by them. Because there is something about resilience and some of these comments bouncing off you, and sometimes they get internalized, and so it's about partly about your response as well.
Yeah.
As to how that arises, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, and comes back to what I was saying about. The frontier of expert psychology in type 1 diabetes.
Yeah. And it was interesting also that people with type 1 reported more stigma than people with type 2. And I would have thought that was the opposite.
I know. So we all did. We all assumed that because of links with obesity and
exactly lifestyle,
the media portray things like diabetes prevention programs and bariatric surgery, and because of the images they choose to stick across their news stories, I think we all assumed that type 2 diabetes would be heavily stigmatized and type 1 wouldn't, and it turns out that's completely the wrong way around, and that was I was gobsmacked by that.
Rose is there and I can see that she's a speaker. Rose, would you like to chip in at all?
Hello. Yeah, someone mentioned psychologist in the chat and it summoned me like a ghost.
You're always welcome here, Rose.
Thank you.
I think it was me and my Ouija board.
But I think, yeah, we've, as Nick was saying, we've just published a systematic review. It wasn't me, it was my one of my PhD students, Rhonda, who did this review on stigma in type 1. And it's interesting with this sort of type 1 having the the higher levels of perceived stigma. But I do wonder if part of it is that, especially if you're sort of looking back in the pre-tech era, and you've got to remember that any research that gets done is always usually a sort of year, maybe two behind, because it takes time to plan these things, it takes time to do the studies, and then you've got to write them up, and then you have very pernickety editors like Nick, who spend a long time.
Oh. I can't believe that of Nick, Rose. I really can't.
Surely.
Nick's one of the good guys. But yeah, all of the research that we have is generally, even the very most current stuff, it does take a while to produce. So you have to bear in mind that a lot of these stigma studies will be looking at things probably in a pre-tech era. And so for a lot of people with type 1 who would have been responding, those care tasks that they're doing with their type 1, whether it's blood glucose checking, whether it's taking your insulin, for most people, they're quite visible tasks. And so I wonder, with being type 1, especially insulin dependent people versus people with type 2 who might just be using either oral medication or diet control, whether visibly having to be looking after your diabetes in public means that people are more likely to chip in with those unhelpful comments, those stigmatizing views. Loads of the young people I work with have had some idiot in school going, "Oh, is that heroin? Oh, you're a smackhead," and things like that, which might not be something that happens so much for people in type 2. So that might be part of it. And I guess,
I was just going to interject, sorry. It did make me think, and this is a part of some of the type 1 community, which I can't say I'm proud of, that they don't want to be seen as having type 2.
Yeah, I think that's...
So they take things that, you know, they've got a double thing, because some people don't want to be seen as being counted in with that, whereas I see different condition, agree that, but we're better in this together than apart.
Yeah.
And I don't have to throw somebody else under the bus to make me feel better. I think it's not good for either type.
Absolutely. And I've certainly worked with a few people who've ended up in a position of quite significant disordered eating because they felt a huge pressure to be slim, to have this sort of lower body weight, to prove that it was nothing to do with diet, so it couldn't be perceived as type 2. I don't know if it's sort of people with type 1 slagging off people with type 2, or whether it just says more about our culture and what we as a culture think of people with type 2 and not wanting to be associated with that. And I guess the other thing is that for a lot of people living with type 1, they might well have grown up with this condition. So they'll have gone through things like high school, which is a god-awful experience for most people at the best of times. But if you're having to do that with diabetes as well, and if diabetes is something that makes you feel more different, or in some cases, the reason that you get rejected or picked on in school, again, that might attune you a little bit more to feeling stigmatized, being a bit more sensitive to any evidence of stigma. Whereas with people with type 2, who generally speaking may have been diagnosed later in life, it might be that age has a bit of an impact that way. But it's a really interesting one. And I think the healthcare side of things is really interesting as well, because we've certainly been thinking a lot about that line almost between stigma and trauma, and how lots of people with type 1, especially if they've had it for a long time, will have had some really awful experiences with healthcare professionals where some well-meaning but ultimately not very effective healthcare professional try to scare them straight, try to sort of give them all this horrible advice. And we know that it's quite often sadly the case that if people with type 1 aren't being reviewed by a specialist, you'll have someone completely wading in and undoing years and years of good work by a specialist team with just one stupid comment. So I think all of those comments and the historical things stay with people. And so it doesn't take much for just somebody saying something like, "Can you eat that?" to suddenly activate years and years of these difficult comments, difficult experiences.
Yeah.
Each comment isn't a new thing. It's added on to 10 or 20 years of baggage each time. And so that might well be in the type 1 world, if people have had it for longer, that it almost has this cumulative effect.
I do believe that, because I always say that when I walk in with like a new healthcare professional, I'm quite sort of, well, not reserved, but I'm sort of sussing them out, because I walk in there with all the baggage that I've picked up over the previous 20 odd years. And like you say, they can say something quite well-meaning, but it'll trigger me because I've had that conversation before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a really difficult thing. And I'd really like to see, as sort of technology develops and the way that our clinics change, we need to start changing the way that we set up our clinic spaces to make them feel more equal, to make them feel less like a head teacher's office, and to feel like it's more of a collaboration. So I think it's, once everybody's on closed loops, I think it's time to really radically rethink how clinic looks.
Yes. Oh no, that's
it. Lippa, can I just jump in? Because we've had Kane come up to the panel. He's got a question that he wants to ask.
Okay.
Kane, if you want to unmute your mic and ask your question.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I put some text, my question in a text box. So can you please go through that question instead of me asking you?
Okay. Claire, do you know what the question was?
Or if you can't read on your screen, then I'm going to just read it out.
Okay.
Okay. I am a Japanese guy living in Japan, and I have type 1 diabetes. And nowadays, in the diabetic patients community or doctors, there's a discussion going on if we keep using a Japanese name for diabetes, which is called Tonyobyo. A literal meaning is sugar urine disease. And that brings to stigma or misunderstanding a lot of negative things to patients, especially to kids, children with type 1 diabetes. So I'm not sure if diabetes in English brings to that kind of negative impressions by itself.
Thinking, are you talking about whether that in Japan you will rename it?
Yes, that's what's being discussed. That's what's being discussed.
Okay. Rose. I can see
this is a really interesting one, because I've recently been meeting with some colleagues about whether we should be developing a Language Matters Wales version. Mm-hmm. And we've come up with some really difficult linguistic issues where, so in the UK Language Matters guidance, which we nicked from Australia, mm-hmm. it's talking about things like managing blood glucose instead of controlling blood glucose. Now in Welsh, mm-hmm. the word for manage and control is rheoli, so it's the same word for both. And the official phrase for diabetes in Welsh is clefyd y siwgr, which again has sugar in the name. It's a difficult one. I think we had a long discussion, and we decided that ultimately the vast majority of people, as long as their care is delivered through the medium of Welsh, aren't as bothered about the meaning of words. So I think it goes culture by culture, really. And it's one of those ones where I think it's difficult with the Language Matters guidance, because it's something that means a lot. But what we don't want to see is just translations around the world without really thinking about the meaning of the words and what they mean. So I think it's a tricky one. I think ultimately what you'd have to go and do is survey lots and lots of people in Japan and see what it is that they would prefer to use. It's got to come from the people. I don't think it's ever as straightforward as translating what's already out there, because language means so many different things to people around the world.
I agree.
Yeah, and I think it is also with some things, and I think with like language matters, which I agree with, and there are certain things that I'm sort of strong opinions with, others I've not, but I think it's the intention with which the words are used that are as important as what the words are themselves. But that's a personal opinion. There. I know one of the questions that came up, and I don't know if Nick, you'd be able to say that. I think it was when we were talking about starting people on pumps, and that you would really, why would you not consider starting them without looping? And it was about access to sensors. Do you think that your practice in your clinic is that? Do you think that will be the same in most clinics, or do you think that's region by region, clinic by clinic, and what their decision is?
Well, we're very privileged, aren't we, in certainly in England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, because we have a national health service. They're slightly different in the devolved nations, but we have a national health service with one guideline, so everyone gets exactly the same thing, don't they?
Obviously. That unicorn great. And pig just threw past
the window. Great side of it. I mean, you know. So there's two sides to that bit, aren't there? Because actually, I do mean that. We are immensely privileged. We do have an NHS. We have a very clear set of NICE guidance and technology appraisals that enable access to a choice of sensor, insulin pump therapy, and hybrid closed loop for the majority of people with type 1 diabetes who would like to self-manage using those technologies. And that is an incredible privilege. But God, we make it hard for ourselves sometimes with local implementations and overcomplicating things when actually we've got perfectly good guidelines already written and we should just get on with implementing them. If there's genuinely somewhere in the UK that has a challenge with sensor availability, I'm halfway through that sentence and I'm already thinking I don't want to finish this because someone's going to tell me something. Do I not want to finish it?
No, it's up to you, Nick.
there can't be places where it's still difficult to get hold of a sensor, surely.
Well, I suppose this also, I'm reading it, I'm not seeing all the notes because I'm talking and doing, I can't do more than one thing at once, Nick, even though I'm a woman.
I can't always do one thing, so you're still ahead of me.
And somebody did comment about, like, with people who are DIY looping with pumps and trying to get access to, like, Dexcom G6 and G7 because they're DIY looping, so it's not like you're an adjunct to a commercial pump. And I can see that is an issue. It must be a bit sort of gutting if you're doing something, you're doing it yourself, you're doing really well, but that makes it difficult for you to access the equipment that would make it better.
Yeah, so I feel conflicted about this one because it is using a device off label and that puts healthcare professionals at a small but genuine risk. And I therefore have some sympathy for healthcare professionals who are uncomfortable doing that. But the other thing to remember is that sometimes healthcare professionals are uncomfortable with this stuff because it's unfamiliar. If you have one person in a clinic of 500 people with type 1 diabetes who does that, that can feel worrying, that can feel concerning, that can feel unsettling. And reverting to prescribing, for want of a better word, because we don't really prescribe sensors generally, but endorsing sensors off label can therefore feel challenging, and I defend people's healthcare professionals' rights to do that. What they might do there is ask the centre down the road that's got five people doing it if they can help and be a bit more collaborative, and we're not always great at doing that.
No, and I appreciate that there's a different viewpoint from you as a healthcare professional, and obviously you are a professional in healthcare, and what will feel comfortable and be doable from our point of view of, well, I'm doing this and da da da. I know Donna Lewis, she once said that people don't appreciate the risks that as a person with type 1 you take every day. You know, we inject a lethal drug and we make up our own doses.
Absolutely.
So I can, yeah, you know, something to us that doesn't seem that much more of a risk, I can see to other people might. Mary, if you've got a question, I can see your hand up patiently.
I'm sorry, it's just to say that, like, in Northern Ireland, Nick, we're part of the UK, and we never commissioned the NICE guidance for advanced CGM. So there's nobody here funded for G6, G7, Guardian 4, Libre 3. We can't even get Libre 3 because that can't be self-funded. So anybody on hybrid closed loop on a commercial system has to self-fund, especially in adults. And we have a 14-year-old, and there are only, I think there's funding for 10% of those in pediatric clinics for advanced CGM that will go on pumps. So there are children and adults started on pumps every single day over here that are loopable, can't hybrid closed loop because there's no funding for it. That's here in Northern Ireland as a region, not just one clinic either, unfortunately.
Yeah. Hopefully now you've got a government, Mary, is all I can say, because I don't think Nick's going to...
Yeah, that's it. We've got a government just literally this past week or so, maybe a couple of weeks. But
I can't hear Mary. Is that just me?
Oh, that might be you. Mary's from Northern Ireland. She's type 1, and she's also got a teenage son who's type 1. And in Northern Ireland, there is no funding for advanced CGM. So there's no G6, G7 or Guardian. I can't remember what number the Guardians are. The Guardian 4.
Four.
Publicly funded. And so they are issuing pumps. People are starting on pumps that are loopable, but the only way people can loop is by self-funding.
And we can only self-fund with Libre
3. That's not great, is it?
We can't self-fund Libre 3 either because it's
not available. But with Libre 2 with Omnipod will be available soon, won't it? I know that isn't helpful.
Yeah.
It is great, though.
Yeah.
That is.
Gosh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. And I think this is one of the things. We've got a national health system, but it's not always national.
No. As you know, I was being flippant.
Yes. That's fine. Yeah. I appreciate you can't comment on other areas either. You know, it's sort of like, I know in London we were really lucky, I mean, years ago when funding came in for CGM because it was the NICE guidance. I know definitely I'm Northwest London. They agreed that if you came under the NICE guidance, which they didn't have to fund, that they would fund the CGM. But I know
lots of areas didn't
follow that.
NG17, 2015, we went to the commissioners there and then, and they said, yeah, sure. And we showed very quickly that we reduced severe hypoglycemia in Northwest London. We have been very fortunate in Northwest London. We've been fortunate with pump funding. We're fortunate with CGM, and we're now fortunate with hybrid closed loop. I say fortunate and privileged, but in some ways also, you know, I can't remember who said this, but the harder you work, the luckier you get. A lot of people have put a huge amount of work into implementing that in Northwest London, and a lot of it also is down to people like you, Philippa, people with type 1 diabetes who are making a clear case and being vocal and supportive of local clinicians. And I think generally as a community, we've worked quite well together, and hopefully generally across London, we've worked quite well together.
I think it is the healthcare professionals as well, because I know you guys have pushed for it and done it. And I know locally, my old consultant, he had a way of getting it for people.
Yeah.
If you know the person involved, you'll know.
I do. Yeah.
And that, not initially, we had nobody on it. And then when that came through, after initially, it took a while for the admin side to be done at our hospital, but that's another story. But then it did go through. And I think, like you say, it was clinicians, but also a lot of people advocating for it as well. So, yeah, I think in some areas, maybe they weren't as lucky. And, you know, that's unfortunate. I'm just very pleased I lived in Northwest London at that point. It saved me a lot of money.
Good.
There. Well, Nick, we have taken up your evening and it's been a fantastic chat. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
That is my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, that is fantastic. And maybe at a later date, we might be able to get you on and talk about some of the research and things that you're involved in, because I know that you are involved in lots of research projects, having taken part in some myself. And it'd be really nice to catch up on some of those if you were willing at some point.
Sure, I'd be delighted. I mean, give everyone a break from my waffles for a few weeks, but very happy to come back if that is what you would like.
That would be brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you also to Rose for jumping on there. That was really interesting. And it's been a really good discussion, and not in the way that I thought it would be. Nick is really big on tech, etc., which I know we've spoken about hybrid closed loop, but it was really nice talking about the psychological impact of diabetes as well in this chat. So thank you again.